I'm here with Kathy Baldock, who calls herself the Canyon Walker.
Yes.
And we're here today to discuss her book, Walking the Bridgeless Canyon, Repairing the Breach Between the Church and the LGBT Community. So, Kathy, why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote it because I kept getting caught in the same trap when I would try to have a conversation. I became what's called an affirming Christian, so inclusive of the LGBT community, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, for full inclusion in the Christian church in about 2008. And every time I would try to have a conversation with people, the conversation kept getting stuck on verses. They would use those verses as a validation for exclusion to Christianity. And it would dissolve when both parties would agree to disagree.
The subtitle of your book, Repairing the Breach. What is the breach you're talking about?
In Isaiah 58:6, it says that there's this breach in a wall. And what that wall is, the wall should have been solid. And over time and through bad practices, the Jews at the time had let the wall go into decay. And God said to the Jews through the prophet Isaiah, if you repair that wall, if you repair the damage that was done, I'll supply all your needs, I'll make you healthy, I'll make you prosperous, and I'll call you the repairers of the breach. So I see this as an issue that the damage was done on this topic, and it never should have happened. When you go through the history and the medical and the political information that I've given in the book, you'll realize that it was false and manipulated information. So the destruction that happened should have never happened. So I'm just trying to inform people of the truth and repair that breach, repair the wall to make it whole again.
You mentioned that there are only 6 references to same-sex attraction in the Bible. What are these passages?
There's 3 in the Old Testament, 3 in the New Testament, and I'm going to correct you there. There's not 6 verses about same-sex attraction. There's 6 verses about same-sex behavior.
Okay.
Big difference, and whenever I'm talking about the Bible, I will never say the word homosexual because I believe there's nothing about it in there. It's something we only started, and the book explains this, I think, really well, that we only started understanding what homosexuality and sexual attraction is in the extreme late 1800s and within the culture starting in 1920. That's pretty recent.
Yeah.
So the 3 sections, the 3 passages in the Old Testament are in Genesis, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and that is a story of violent rape, trying to put down or subjugate the visitors to the town that were actually there to check out how evil the city was. So, yeah, they did.
They found what they were looking for.
They did.
Yeah.
So we had people trying to rape the visitors to the city. And all through history, what we know is when a man was treated as a woman, when a man was penetrated and sexually treated like a woman, that was the most demeaning thing you could do to a man. And then we see in Leviticus, and Leviticus is a strange time in the history of the Jews. They're coming out of Egypt. And they're going right into the Canaanites culture. They're going from one pagan culture to another. God lays out all these laws, over 600 rules, and he said, okay, you're coming out of here, you're going into there. I want you to look different than the people you're moving into because I need you to stay separate. So he gives laws that are all about boundaries and exclusions and warnings about keeping things separate. So that's why we see things like why certain kinds of foods are edible, why certain kinds of clothing are wearable, why you can't plant 2 kinds of seeds in the same field. Everything is to be separated. And hence, men and women's roles have to be separated. But there was also another problem going on. The pagans subjugated boys. So men would have sex with males to subjugate them and to treat them like women and to dishonor them, and because they fed their own lusts.
It's all about submission.
It's all about submission
and power
and lust.
And dominance.
Power, lust, out-of-control behavior. And then in the New Testament, we see it in Romans, in Corinthians, and Timothy. Again, what we're seeing is people, God's basically saying in those verses, everyone is going to get out of control at some point. I need you to be righteous, to be in relationship with me. None of you is going to do it correctly. Without the power of the Holy Spirit, we would call it, in your lives, you're going to get out of control. Let me show you what out of control looks like. And in Romans, he shows what is utterly out of control for the time. People fulfilling their own lusts, people having sex out of the strata that they're supposed to. They're subjugating men in the position of women, so they're out of their sexual social roles, and they're having sex that's non-procreative. We don't even know what the women were doing. We just know that they lack self-control, they were out of their roles, and whatever they were doing was not towards procreation.
Those are the three Old Testament verses.
So those are the Old Testament. Romans is in the New Testament. And then the ones from Timothy and Corinthians.
Also New Testament.
Also New Testament are two Greek words. One we know, one we don't know the exact meaning. The one is associated with don't behave like a woman, not just sexually, but have the immoderate tone of a woman, like being lazy and lustful and excessive food, drink, just being out of control like a woman.
And what is that word?
That word is malakoi.
Okay.
And it translates as effeminate. And then the other word is arsenikoitai. We don't know exactly what that means. It was used less than 100 times in literature in a 600-year period and always in lists. But when it's used, it's always used with sex that has either a money exchange or a power differential. So none of those situations are about mutually loving, same-sex attracted relationships. They're all about out-of-control, lustful expressions of sex, abusive expressions of sex. But in 1970s, when it started really taking hold that it meant like those people, the gay people, they took those words that had all these other meanings that never even included women, the sexual behavior of women, especially with each other, and they made those words homosexual.
Briefly tell us where the wedge between religion and homosexuality began.
This can be a surprising answer because it's a great question that lots of Christians will ask, and the standard answer will be, well, it's always been this way, or it's been that way for 2,000 years, but it's completely inaccurate. The reality is that the first Christians in the United States that ever made any kind of fuss about what would have been called homosexuals. The word gay wasn't even used even in an organization until 1972. So the first people making a fuss about homosexuals were some fundamentalist Methodist preachers in West Texas that were doing open-air revivals. And they realized that when they started talking about the dirty, filthy, horrible gays in a fearful way that they were, you know, possibly infiltrating homes and families, it was a good way to get people into the revival tents. Then it kind of went silent. Nobody was doing anything until Anita Bryant came along in 1978. And she was a fundamentalist Christian, very popular within the culture. Well, she was afraid that there was an ordinance that was about to come to vote in her county commission of Miami-Dade County. And all this ordinance was protected people from not being hired or being fired for what was called their sexual preference. Nobody called it an orientation then. And she saw this, and she was afraid that gay people might be able to be teachers in her Baptist school where she sent her four children. And if these gay teachers were in her school, they wouldn't be able to fire them. They'd have to hire them. And she was sure that gay people were pedophiles and out to recruit her children. She started a campaign called Save Our Children, and the Save Our Children campaign, started by Anita Bryant in 1978, was what galvanized the conservative Christian voices in the United States and the gay rights movement, which was not national.
So it began as a protest of a new anti-discrimination law that was being discussed in the state of Florida.
In one county.
In one county.
In one county.
Okay.
So she brought this to the national forefront, and just about then, Jerry Falwell was being seduced by people on the political right. They were trying to find a wedge issue. They'd been looking for one since the 60s. School prayer didn't stick. Tax-exempt status for charitable institutions didn't stick after the Bob Jones case in the mid-1970s. Even abortion. So the conservative political movement, who was trying to re-engage the largest untapped voters group in the United States, which were fundamentalist and conservative Christians, were looking for a wedge issue. And Anita Bryant handed it to them. So Jerry Falwell lit right into that one.
So then you have this new wedge issue between mm-hmm. religion and or for the new political football, if you will.
Right.
And then Reagan gets elected, and now it's the 1980s, and HIV and AIDS comes along.
Bad timing.
And as you say in your book, religious leaders found a way to use the Bible to explain the appearance of this new disease.
None of the mainstream denominational religions had said anything. The Methodists, Presbyterians, the Lutherans, until 1987. They didn't start making declarations. But what happened in the late 70s is the Federal Communications Administration changed their rulings, and all of a sudden, we got televangelists. We never had televangelists before. They found out that talking about the gays brought money to their ministries. And they were the voice of the Christian church about what God thought about gay people and the cause of AIDS for 7 years in this country. And it's just like a head of a tick that gets under your skin. You can pull that body out and say, oops, no, we made a mistake. This is where AIDS really came from, but the poison was in there. And it's still in there. I mean, I read columns still in conservative forums, and within 8 or 9 comments down, we could be talking about any topic tangentially related to gay people or trans people, and they're still talking about how AIDS is a gay disease.
How are you able to flip this paradigm?
Well, there are several people that have changed the dynamic and tone of this conversation, I would say, in the last 2 to 3 years. Before that, there were people kind of yelling from both sides. But in the last few years, the people at the top of the conversation have very much changed their tone, and I get to work with those people on this issue, and we all are incredibly similar in terms of we're gracious. We do exemplify the witness of Jesus, who we're trying to be like. We're also really well-educated, and we're patient people. So I get to work with people like Justin Lee, who wrote Torn. He was one of the first to do this. He's the head of the Gay Christian Network. And Matthew Vines, who wrote God and the Gay Christian. And I'm on his board, and I'm on Justin's advisory board. And then David Gushy, who is one of the main evangelical ethicists of our time. And Dr. James Brownson, who was a 32-year teacher of New Testament theology, and my book. And we started coming out with these books, which supported people changing and seeing a different way to see their theology and to see that their theology was very influenced by ideology. And at the same time, we have this confluence of LGBT Christians that are coming out, that are being educated, that are standing up for themselves and not leaving their churches, that are confronting their leaders. And another wonderful dynamic that's only happened in the last 3 years are parents of gay kids. And they're starting to not turn their backs on their children, which they have been doing in the past.
You've created a dialogue.
Yes.
Between the LGBT community and the church.
And it's a different tone. That's what's different. In the last 3 or 4 years, the tone has changed.
You have a lot of history that has really been institutionalized in our culture. How do you plan on repairing this breach? What seems like an almost impossible task?
It seems overwhelming. The way I lay the book out, it's along a timeline, and I just start connecting. Like, I start connecting the cultural attitudes of same-sex behavior and men's and women's sexual social roles. And then I start bringing in the early 1900s, the psychoanalysts. They were the first that deemed that homosexuality, this sexual attraction, was a mental illness, and how they came to those conclusions, which were not ever based in research, never based in research. And so I just keep connecting the dots so that by the time we get to even talking about the Bible in the 9th chapter, it should be incredibly clear to the reader that something is very wrong here.
How do you approach religious leaders who still disagree with you? How do you have a dialogue with those people?
I quickly sort of slot people in my head. So there's 20 to 30% that are fully there on this issue. There's 20 to 30% that I would call fundamentalists or very conservative, and 40 to 60 in the middle. So my concentration is the middle. But when the 20 to 30 on the other end come to me, if they still are saying things like sexual orientation is a choice or it's a mental illness or a rebellion, I probably won't invest very much time there because the learning curve is so high. But if they have already started questioning, and they're in this cognitive dissonance that, wait a minute, I know someone's gay. My own child is gay. My sister is gay. A wonderful member of our worship team just came out as gay. But what I've taught is this. And they're in this messy jumble in their head, and they're ready to hear. And what I've become is a really good question asker. So I try to find their pain point, and then I try to address it. And I'm also pretty good at slotting people into the next step for them, whether that be going to conferences or education through the Reformation Project that I'm associated with, or the next book they should read, or another pastor in the area. I really do try to connect people so that people are walking through this in community to try to find answers, because I'm convinced that through relationship and really good education, if a person is truly pursuing the path of what Jesus would do, the place they're going to eventually come to is full inclusion of LGBT Christians within the church and repentance for the damage that they've done, the destruction they've done to the breach.
At the end of a couple of chapters, you give some personal testimonies.
Mm-hmm.
In the chapter on HIV and AIDS, you write, "Where were you, Kathy?"
Oh, see, I'm going to cry now.
Asking yourself why you weren't more compassionate during this time in the 80s.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, is this book a confession?
It's not a confession, but there are certain things that I completely resonate with. When I started to write that AIDS chapter and I saw the example of my friends Bob and Jan Baer that I put in that were a good chapter, and I know my response. When I heard a friend of my ex-husband's had just died of AIDS, I was so non-compassionate. And now I know hundreds of people that are living with AIDS, and I know now how AIDS happened. It started in the 1920s. It started because of the result of colonialism. It started with power and money again. And I spent all those years judging people. And I think what people know about me when they know me well is I don't like to hurt people. And my judgment, whether I spoke them out loud to people or not, my judgments about people with AIDS were wrong. And I represented a church that turned our back on the gay community that really was being disowned by their families and lost so much. And it should have been Christians that exemplified compassion, and we did exactly the opposite. So it's very painful for me to think I was part of all that destruction. That was a difficult chapter to write, and even when I read it on the audio, you can hear every time I read it, I think, oh, I cannot believe, where were you, Kathy? You were judging. It's a terrible place to have been when I realized all the pain that was going on, and I didn't know it. I didn't see it. Didn't even see it.